Our calendar is 55751. This is Salcido versus District Court. Mr. Eisenberg is going to remain at council table. We'll allow the others to take their places. Good morning, Mr. Sampson. Mr. Eisenberg, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. Again, Your Honor, I'm going to attempt to reserve 5 minutes. May it please the Court, Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the petitioner, Dr. Salcido. This petition presents the Court with an opportunity to clarify, really once and for all, the statutory requirement dealing with an affidavit in a medical malpractice case. Statute 41A.071 has two requirements. First, that the affidavit has to be by a medical expert who practices in an area substantially similar to the defendant's practice. And second, the affidavit has to support the allegations contained in the action. In this case, the affidavit was by a medical doctor, Dr. Rousseau. The entire extent of any indication in the affidavit regarding his qualifications is that he's a licensed physician in the state of Nevada. That's it. No CV attached, no indication about what he specializes in, if he has a specialty, no indication as to what his area of practice is, nothing.
Beyond that, what specifically was in the affidavit to support any allegations of malpractice by Dr. Salcido?
Nothing, absolutely zero. The malpractice in this case originally was alleged against Dr. Martin, who was the emergency room physician, and the nurse practitioner who did the intubation, who was under Dr. Martin's supervision. When the lawsuit was filed and Dr. Rousseau filed his affidavit, he focused entirely on Dr. Martin and the nurse. When they added Dr. Salcido, all they did was retype the affidavit so it looks different, but the content of it is exactly the same. It attacks Dr. Martin and the nurse. It doesn't mention Dr. Salcido's name. It doesn't give the slightest suggestion that she did anything wrong, and it doesn't give any basis for a judge to look at it and say, okay, they have an expert who says that Dr. Salcido did something wrong. This court has said that the purpose of that statute, both prongs of it, the fact that the doctor who files the affidavit has to be in the same area of practice as the defendant, and the fact that the affidavit has to identify what the malpractice was, both parts of that statute are important to prevent frivolous lawsuits. And it was part of the comprehensive legislation that was adopted when the legislature got rid of the screening panels. As a substitute for the screening panels, they imposed the affidavit requirement. And we contend that both prongs of that statute are important, and that the district judge's decision here basically rendered the statute meaningless. In the Borger case, which is the closest case that this court has decided to this, that was the case that presented the question of whether a general surgeon could present an affidavit in a case involving a defendant gastroenterologist. And this court said he could because the general surgeon's work included, to some extent, within his scope of his work, gastroenterology. But the courts said that the expert's practice must be reasonably related to the defendant's area of practice. This affidavit contained absolutely no foundational information regarding the doctor's specialty. And Dr. Salcido is a hospitalist. That's a very narrow specialty. And no indication at all that Dr. Rousseau knew the slightest thing about the standard for a hospitalist. In addition to the requirement of supporting the allegations, the affidavit gave no indication that Dr. Salcido was negligent at all. And the purpose of the affidavit would be so a district court judge can do some initial screening to make sure, number one, that the expert is qualified to give an affidavit on this particular specialty, and number two, to make sure that there is, in fact, a medical doctor out there who's willing to say that the defendant, this specific defendant in this case, did not comply with the standard of care for doctors within her specialty. And this affidavit didn't do either of those. We believe that the insufficiency of the affidavit issue is an important issue where this court can render guidance to the bench and bar and is dispositive of this particular case. But even if you somehow decide that the affidavit issue isn't dispositive, there still was the statute of limitations issue here. The plaintiff filed a complaint, amended complaint, second amendment.
Mr. Eisenberg, I'd like to follow up, if I may, before you get into the statute of limitations argument. If the court, in reviewing the affidavit, the panel concludes that the affidavit doesn't identify Dr. Salcido or state a basis for his malpractice, then is that really something that the court and bar need guidance on? How do we reach the issue of sufficiency of qualifications if the affidavit is simply defective because it doesn't name the doctor or tell why he is guilty of malpractice?
Well, I think we have at least one judge here, Judge Bixler, who wasn't able to accept or the argument that this affidavit was insufficient. Whether there are others, I don't know, but certainly it would be helpful for the bench and bar to know that the affidavit must contain the foundational information with which the trial judge can determine whether the statute was satisfied. And that's really the rub here, is that there's nothing in the affidavit that gives the district judge the information to determine whether both prongs of the statute are satisfied. So certainly it would be helpful to the bench and bar at least to be told that the statute requires that foundational information to be in the affidavit. To get to the statute of limitations issue briefly, finally, after about the third amended complaint, they add Dr. Salcedo, long after we contend the statute of limitations had run. Her work as a hospitalist, as the district judge found here, was throughout the medical record. Her involvement was mentioned 17 times in the medical records. And the judge found that that there had been extensive reference to her. The judge found that the plaintiff should have named Dr. Salcedo far earlier, that the plaintiffs demonstrated a lack of diligence. But in order to allow the case to proceed against a statute of limitations challenge, what the district judge said was that, okay, the plaintiffs have to prove that Dr. Salcedo was aware of the action early on. And that's the Serviatis case. I think that's how you pronounce it. That if she had notice of the action earlier, before the statute of limitations run, then she could be added later on. Well, the judge said that Dr. Salcedo must have had notice that this action was filed because the hospital was sued, therefore she should have known. There's absolutely nothing in the record to support that. Then the judge said, well, she was named as a witness in the discovery disclosures, so she must have known about the lawsuit. Well, the fact is she was named in the plaintiff's discovery disclosures, and she never knew that. And then the judge said, the fact that she rendered the medical care to this patient was enough to put her on notice that she could be sued later on. Well, there's nothing in the record to support that, and that's not notice of a lawsuit. That's just some kind of anticipatory notice. She filed an uncontested, unrebutted affidavit saying that she did not have notice of this lawsuit until she was served with the second or third amended complaint, whatever it was. And we believe there's absolutely no basis for the district judge's decision. The plaintiffs here did not exercise reasonable diligence to amend the complaint early on. They knew full well about Dr. Salcido's involvement in the case. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Russo's affidavit, which was attached to the original complaint, mentions that he reviewed all the medical records in the case. Of course, he was focusing on Dr. Martin's conduct, not Dr. Salcedo. But if he read those records and the plaintiff's counsel had them early on, Dr. Salcedo's mentioned throughout, and the statute of limitations, we believe, as a matter of law, ran far earlier than what the district court found here. If the court doesn't have any questions, I reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Sampson.
Honorable Justices, may it please the court. I want to jump right to Justice Perigary's question that was followed up by Justice Hardesty in terms of Dr. Salcedo not being mentioned in the affidavit. It goes directly to the statute itself, NRS 41A.071. And Mr. Eisenberg has said a couple things that he claims are deficient in the affidavit. He says there's no CV, there's no history. That's not required in the affidavit. They're not required by the rule. That's required when an expert produces a report pursuant to the discovery rules to testify as an expert in a lawsuit. But those requirements are not set forth in the affidavit of merit.
Mr. Sampson, without that information, if it's not set forth in the affidavit itself, how would a judge determine whether or not that doctor was qualified, in fact, to author the affidavit?
Well, I think initially the judge can determine they're qualified because the affidavit itself, in this case from Dr. Russo, says, I am a doctor who practices or has practiced in an area that is substantially similar to the type of practice engaged at the time of the alleged malpractice. Essentially, it's Dr. Russo saying, look, this man had a nasogastric tube after he aspirated. They removed it to do his scan, and he aspirated again and died. You do not remove a nasogastric tube when someone has already aspirated once and almost died and required having the tube put in place, because there's a high likelihood within the next day or so that they're going to aspirate again and have the same issue. You don't need to be a hospitalist to know that. And we've had objections from, in my practice, that run the gamut in terms of, well, this guy is not this particular specialty or doesn't wear the same color code or whatever else. And it's simply, would you know, in your experience, and Dr. Russo, when they do now have his affidavit, or they do now have his CV, and it was produced as part of discovery, so in terms of coming over the initial hurdle to let it in, does the affidavit indicate that he practices in the same area? If the doctor is given his word on the affidavit, he does. I think that would get us past, for example, an initial motion to dismiss. If upon discovery and deposing the doctor, it turns out he has absolutely zero experience in this area, then I think that could be subject of a motion for summary judgment. However, Dr. Russo, in his CV that was produced as part of the case, part of his expert report, indicates he has significant experience. He did a surgical residency, has spent years practicing in the emergency room, knows about when you are and are not allowed to remove a nasogastric tube. It's not something that is a highly technical area of medicine, that if a man can't breathe and has a tube helping him breathe, don't take it out until he can breathe on his own, or if there's a risk that he'll aspirate again and breathe on its own. It's something that's not specialized to any particular expertise, and certainly someone who's worked for a number of years, as Dr. Russo has, in the medical industry, working in the ER, would have that knowledge. He swore in his affidavit he had that knowledge, and it comes to fruition as part of discovery that he, in fact, does. Now, the other part of the statute, 41A, says the affidavit has to support the allegations contained in the action. It doesn't say it has to identify a specific doctor. It has to support the allegations contained in the action. And the affidavit says, when a doctor removes a nasogastric tube, that is below the standard of care. Now, the records do indicate that it was Dr. Martin involved with the nasogastric tube itself. Dr. Salcedo was involved in other aspects, and I think 2 weeks after the aspiration, at the close of Mr. Pacelli's coma, 2 days before he passed away, she does a discharge summary and summarizes the treatment that was done. She sees him on various other occasions as part of his three-week coma that he was in. But there is no record anywhere that says Dr. Salcedo is the one that ordered the tube removed. In fact, all of the records, as indicated in the affidavit, indicate Dr. Martin. In fact, even today, counsel indicated this was under Dr. Martin's supervision, as he says he addressed this very court. Because the matter's been on stay, we haven't actually been able to depose Dr. Martin and get the specific, or even Dr. Salcedo, to find out exactly what went on. But as Dr. Russo reviewed the records, they indicated Dr. Martin's the one that's involved with the nasogastric tube. He's the one that had the supervision of the nurses that were involved in that process and would have been the one then naturally to remove the tube. It wasn't until a year and a half later, as part of discovery in an interrogatory response, that Dr. Martin for the first time said, no, I put the tube in place, but subsequent to that, it was all Dr. Salcedo that was in charge of the nasogastric tube, and there's no record that indicates this transfer of responsibility. It's just simply Dr. Martin's testimony. And for all we know, we may very well find out when we depose Dr. Salcedo that it was, in fact, no Dr. Martin that stayed on the watch. The bottom line is, whether it's Dr. Martin, whether it's Dr. Salcedo, whether it's a hospitalist, a cardiologist, a pulmonologist, whoever, you don't take a nasal gastric out of a man who needs it to breathe.
Mr. Sampson, returning to the legal question that's posed in the appeal, whether the affidavit satisfied the statute, a couple of points of clarification. I have in front of me a copy of an affidavit apparently signed by Dr. Russo that indicates that it's dated as of January 11th, 2008 on page 93 of the record, but then it looks like it was notarized on September 22nd, 2009 on page 96 of the record. Is this the affidavit that was attached to the third amended complaint adding Dr. Salcedo to the case?
As I stand here right now, I do not know. I could certainly check that out and supplement it. I did not anticipate the question. My thought would be that it, in fact, was based on the based on the dates.
If this notary stamp is consistent with what I believe is the correct affidavit and the timeline, because I think your third amended complaint was filed in roughly September or so of 2009, could you tell me where in this affidavit, and this, of course, is post your discovery of Dr. Martin's deposition testimony.
It was an interrogatory answer, yes.
Yeah, okay. Where in this affidavit does Dr. Russo, we know it doesn't mention Salcedo. I assume you concede that. Where in here does it even mention anything having to do with Salcedo? Why wouldn't this affidavit include a reference to the interrogatory response, for example, that Salcedo was the one that took over responsibility for the tube and its removal, that its removal when he was transferred for some additional testing and the respirator was disconnected. None of that's here. I'm at a loss to understand where in this affidavit Salcedo or his negligence is referred to by Russo.
And the negligence, the identity of the negligent party is identified as per the medical records as Dr. Martin. And certainly in answer to Your Honor's question, the affidavit could have indicated, and if it turns out that it was in fact Dr. Salcedo as Dr. Martin claims, then it would be it's the same negligence. I mean, we certainly could have put that in there. The point being, it's not required under the statute. It simply says you have to support the allegations of the complaint. And the allegations of the complaint say...
Well, I guess that's why I posed the question to Mr. Eisenberg. It seems kind of fundamental that the language support the allegations made is referring to the doctor who's the defendant in the case. And I guess a little surprised that an opinion is necessary to tell the legal community that when you attach an affidavit to a complaint for malpractice, it ought to at least identify the doctor who's a defendant.
Well, and the concern with that, Your Honor,
seems maybe I'm being missing something. It seems awful fundamental.
Well, it's certainly the statute requires you to support the allegations contained in the action. The complaint identifies Dr. Salcedo. The complaint does have that language that says if it was Dr. Salcedo, because we've now been told on information and belief it may have been Dr. Salcedo, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, I'm not quoting the complaint, that it was in fact Dr. Salcedo that was involved, then she would be equally negligent. The only thing that the affidavit would be required to say is, again, removing the tube is below the standard of care.
And Mr. Sampson, isn't the point of, as I recall, the legislation that gave rise to these requirements designed to protect doctors from frivolous litigation and requiring that these issues be identified early in the proceeding?
That is correct. That is correct. And again, the identity of the individual, however, also from the legislative history, as Judge Bixler quoted, the quote from Bill Bradley that said, we would like to see more of a summary affidavit. And it's not to be, as he says, it'd be unfair to require a full-blown affidavit because there's such limited information available in the record without the ability to ask anyone what happened or why there was not any records for this past day. And again, then he indicates, we'd like to see more of a summary affidavit. The doctor's opinion, Dr. Russo would not be an expert on whether Dr. Martin or Dr. Salcedo or someone else removed this tube. He wasn't there. He can't be an expert in that area. What he can tell you is, if a doctor removes the tube, as his affidavit indicates, the removal of the tube in the circumstance is a breach of the standard of care. The complaint then alleges, and it clearly alleges, Dr. Salcedo, upon information and belief now with this new discovery, was the one who actually removed the tube. That, coupled with an affidavit that says the removal of the tube is negligent, is more than sufficient to advise the defendants as to what is going on, advise them as to what is being pled, and they know the allegations in terms of what the action consists of.
Mr. Sampson, assume that to be true. How do we get around the fact that Dr. Salcedo, at least according to her affidavit, didn't have any notice that she was going to be involved in this until the third amended complaint was filed on or about October of 2009?
Correct, and that takes us to the statute of limitations issue and the question of servatius and whether it relates back. Judge Bixler did not accept that argument, and I think it is completely, it approaches ridiculous to think that a Dr. Martin, now I'm talking about, Dr. Martin and the hospital and the employers are sued. Dr. Martin knows full well, apparently, he says, I got sued for this. I mean, you know, he's advised as to what's going on, and his position is, I never did this, it was Dr. Salcedo, and that he never broached that subject with her. And we've never even had an opportunity, we could have had an evidentiary hearing perhaps, and perhaps that's the appropriate remedy, is to say, you know, at what point in time did you advise Dr. Salcedo that this was going on? But that the idea that a negligence medical malpractice action is proceeding against the wrong doctor, who says, it's quite frankly, his defense is, it wasn't me, it was someone else, and that someone else never, ever even finds out about it.
So Dr. Salcedo's affidavit was incorrect.
Well, I think Judge Bixler didn't buy it, is the best way to indicate it. It seems to me to be rather unbelievable. And it would surprise me, and unfortunately we're not permitted to do this type of discovery in state malpractice actions, but it would not surprise me in the least if there was some kind of peer review done to cover this, particularly after the action was filed, and to think that a colleague that works day-to-day in the same facility as Dr. Salcedo would get sued for malpractice when it was never him, it was some other doctor, and never advise her of that fact. And again, when we have the Emergency Medical Physicians Group, of which they're a member, is being included in the action, St. Rose is included in the action, and yet at no point in time does anyone ever mention this to Dr. Salcedo when she's completely oblivious as to what's going on. It seems rather incredible, and certainly was not found to be credible by Judge Bixler, who said, you know, based on what's gone on, it's quite clear she would have had information to know, in fact, that she was the one that was being involved in this lawsuit. It was the very first, I call it testimony, but again, it's an interrogatory answer that we received from Dr. Martin, was to say, it's not me, it's someone else. I know I'm on there initially as a person who did the nasogastric tube, but I passed that on to Dr. Salcedo at some subsequent time when there are no records that indicate that. So the very idea that he kept mum about this until he filed the interrogatory answer, I think is difficult to believe, and certainly wasn't accepted by the lower court. In terms of the other issues, and I can turn to that on the relation back in the 2.5 minutes I have left, the actual notice and that they are, in fact, the proper third-party defendant, and there's certainly no misleading. There can be no idea that, oh, they're because they filed this a year and a half later after they got the interrogatory answer, that we were somehow looking to mislead Dr. Salcedo, and that somehow evidence has been lost that she could have otherwise preserved, or witnesses have memories have faded because of evidence that could have otherwise been preserved, but that she was misled into thinking we were going to give her a pass. And it's quite clear from the outset and from the affidavit itself, the records indicate Dr. Martin was the one involved. The malpractice is the malpractice no matter who does it. Again, whether it's Dr. Martin, Dr. Salcedo, the allegations of the complaint set out the who did what, and the doctor's affidavit is to say this action that is taken is below the standard of care. And to say the doctor's affidavit has to then charge and properly identify the proper parties, and the doctor, Dr. Russo, has to swear now in an affidavit that, well, maybe it was this and maybe it was that, but either way it's negligence, I think that's redundant. It's unnecessary. He says this is a negligent action. There's certainly nothing specific in the affidavit that says because it was Dr. Martin, it was negligent, but it was negligence, but had it been someone else, it wouldn't have been negligence. I mean, it's negligent no matter what doctor performs the procedure, what doctor removes the tube. And when the complaint says in one paragraph, Dr. Martin removed the tube according to the records, and in another paragraph says in the alternative and upon information and belief it was Dr. Salcedo, those allegations are supported by the complaint that says that the removal of the tube is what constitutes negligence. Unless the court had any additional questions, I've got about 45 seconds left.
Colleagues?
Thank you
very much, Mr. Simpson. Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. Counsel started by making a rather serious mistake here. He said that Dr. Rousseau's affidavit, which, by the way, Justice Hardesty, that the affidavit to which you referred on page 93, was attached to the third amendment. The counsel said that that affidavit states that Dr. Rousseau said something to the effect that he's a doctor in substantially similar practice to Dr. Salcedo. It does not say that. What it says is, I am a physician licensed to practice medicine in the state of Nevada since 1982. I am qualified to comment and render opinions regarding Mr. Pacelli's illness, as well as the care he received during his hospital stay at St. Rose Siena, based on my education, experience, and training, and that's it. The statute requires him to either have practiced or be in practice in a substantially similar practice or area of practice as Dr. Salcedo. He doesn't say that. Justice Seda, you asked a question essentially asking when should the information be provided. And as you pointed out, the purpose of this statute is for an initial screening. The statute was adopted, the affidavit requirement, as I mentioned earlier, as a substitute for the screening panels, which used to be the way that medical malpractice cases were screened. Now the legislature says that before you can file a medical malpractice case, you have to get an affidavit from a doctor who will swear under oath that there's a substantial basis for this medical malpractice claim. And that doctor has to be in a substantially similar practice as the defendant doctor. That's the initial screening. And Justice Sata counsel says, well, we can do discovery and then we can have a motion for summary judgment later on if it turns out that the doctor who gave the affidavit wasn't qualified. That's the whole purpose of the affidavit requirement, is to avoid that, so that there's initial screening to weed out the frivolous lawsuits, to make sure that that malpractice action isn't filed unless there's a doctor willing to go on the record and swear that the defendant doctor did in fact commit malpractice. That's what it's all about. I would also ask, how difficult is it? And by the way, counsel, I think he said something about the CV being produced during discovery, and I'm not sure he said it was or it could have been. But if it was, that's not part of this record. And if it could have been, that also goes to my other point, that the whole purpose of the affidavit is to weed out cases so doctors don't have to go through hiring lawyers, defending, going through discovery, answering interrogatories, appearing at depositions, unless there's an affidavit that meets the statutory foundation first. So how difficult is it in an affidavit to identify what the doctor's specialty is, not the defendant doctor, but the affiant doctor, and for that doctor to state, I've read the records, and in my opinion, the defendant doctor failed to comply with the standard of care because, in a few sentences, explaining why. That's all the statute really requires, and there's no burden at all. And then finally, counsel has engaged in what can't be characterized as anything less than wild speculation. For him to stand here and tell you that because Dr. Martin got sued, he must have told Dr. Salcedo that, well, I'm not sure what he's claiming Dr. Martin would have told Dr. Salcedo. I guess Dr. Martin could have said, I got sued. Doesn't say anything about Dr. Salcedo being sued. That's wild speculation for him to suggest that. And what this case, what this court said in the Servetius case, is that the defendant who's being added to the case had to have actual notice of the action and actual notice that that defendant was part of the action. And counsel's speculation that Dr. Martin may have said something to Dr. Salcedo does not constitute actual notice.
Mr. Eisenberg, the trial court, as part of its order denying the motion to dismiss, said this. Although Dr. Salcedo is not specifically referenced in the affidavit, the affidavit makes it clear that it is Dr. Russo's opinion that the medical care in general rendered during Mr. Pacelli's hospital stay fell below the standard of care. Where in the affidavit that I said was the one I referenced in my question to Mr. Sampson is that opinion? Maybe I should have posed that question to Mr. Sampson, but I'm trying to understand where the judge got that conclusion from.
It isn't in the affidavit. The only thing the affidavit focuses on is the is Dr. Martin who rendered the emergency care upon the admission, and the nurse who did the endotracheal intubation. That's the only thing he focuses on. He says, on appendix page 95, paragraph 2, regarding medical treatment, it is my opinion that Dr. Martin's rendering of the emergency care and the admission fell below the standard of care. A critical situation existed. It was obvious that the nurse practitioner wasn't experienced and things dealing with Dr. Martin. And then he says, second, falls below the standard of care for nursing personnel to send a patient who's on a respirator to another department, et cetera, et cetera. There's not a single word focusing on anything that a hospitalist, Dr. Salcedo, did wrong. So there simply is no basis for the district court's, for that part of the district court's order. If the court has no further questions,
thank you very much, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Sampson, thank you for your time and your attention to this matter. This case will stand submitted.